Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. How's everybody doing?
Great. Hey, Dave. It's Mary Beth.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. And yourself?
Super. What kind of progress notes do you have?
Actually, I was trying to determine if I missed the session where you addressed some of the marketing aspects or if that is still yet to come.
We talked about practice and the business aspects of practice in a seminar. I've more addressed the business aspects of the practice, and I don't have a separate segment on marketing. Are there aspects of marketing that you'd like us to discuss? I mean, we have a little bit of extra time today because Amy Cowan has had to postpone the completion of her training. She was going to do the roadmap, so we have more time to discuss whatever would be most helpful to you. So if there are some aspects of marketing that you'd like to discuss, I know Jen has a good deal of experience and is also a mentor trainer coach at Coach Training Alliance, and I'm sure we could all put together our best practices and ideas if there are aspects that you'd like us to talk about. Did you hear the recording of the seminar where we did? It was on address some aspects of the business components.
I'm not sure if I did or not. When I log on to the playback website, I don't see anything on there past, I want to say, November 11th.
It should be up. Contact Bill. It's support@mentorpath.com if you have any trouble downloading or doing the playback.
Okay.
It should be up within 24 hours of our actual seminar.
Okay. Well, I can give that a shot.
Okay.
Basically, I just, the idea of like group programs and things along that line are kind of new to me. I've been doing a lot of one-on-one sessions.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just looking for ideas on how to proceed down that path.
Okay. I have some protocols that I have done for group coaching. Actually, they're ones I used for groups who have done training with me who requested to do group coaching to go over components of the workbook. And for those groups, we had a fixed amount of time. And the workbook actually really does work good for that. We had an eight month group that was time limited. One was six, one was eight, one was 9 months. And we meet the first 3 weeks of the month. I meet for 75 minutes. And I'll send around to the group some of the, like the emails and the protocols that I do for groups. It's a terrific way to do groups. And when, you don't have to have the prompts of like the workbook, but I had a segment very much like the 28-week protocol that you downloaded when you signed up. There was just like a component of the workbook that corresponded with each group, but we would treat the group in the same way that we would do check-ins and then look at what the group wanted to cover. Most often it was some aspect of what the exercises and work tools were that was done by the entire group that time. But it's the same as an individual. You look at what the group elects to do for that group, and then at the end it's a wrap-up. I do a wrap-up of looking at what was the most important thing they got out of the group and what they commit to do for between now and the next group, very much like an individual. So it's a terrific process of really developing the energy and the cohesiveness of the group wisdom. So it's a very powerful experience. Has Jen arrived yet?
Yeah, I'm here, Dave.
What's your experience in doing groups?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways to go about it. As you're suggesting too, it's totally up to what you want to see happen. I took Jackie Black's group coaching, which I thought was a great offering, so I recommend that. But I think a lot of the elements that most coaches have questions about is, you know, is it an open group or is it a closed group? Does it have a beginning, a middle, and an end, or is it ongoing? What's the best format? Is it by phone or is it by Skype? Is it by in person? But there's a lot of questions that once answered, it's really quite a lovely modality, you know, to bring into your practice. And it's a catch-all for, you know, those clients who say, well, I really can't afford it or I choose not to afford it at this time. You know, your one-on-one coaching, you can say, well, I offer for that, you know, the same target market, I offer a more affordable group coaching opportunity. You don't get as much time with me, but it's a nice, like, net, you know, you can catch those clients with that you don't close on the one-on-one.
And some people really like the collaboration and the mutual support and discussion that evolves in a group. And as Jen said, there are a lot of possibilities. There's also a Sage and Scholars Guide that Dr. Jackie does on coaching groups is the recording of her teleseminar series plus the text from that. And it's the essence of all the things that she does. She even has sample emails that she sends out at certain times before the group and getting prepping people for the group. So does that even begin to answer some of your questions about groups?
Yes, actually it does. That's all good information. I was sitting here writing notes feverishly after talking about that.
And in my experience, I have done all groups by telephone. I do all of my work by telephone, even people here in Houston. But groups is very possible also to do by telephone. I get get everybody to send a picture and a bio and send those around. And I have on my lap desk a picture and the bio of everybody, so it's like I have a visual, and we develop ways of working by telephone that works really, really well. Jen, do you do both in-person and telephone?
I just do telephone.
Yeah, okay.
It's just, you know, you can cast a wider net, and it's just so much more convenient. And one last final thought about groups is that there's so much easier to, I mean, it doesn't have to be difficult, and it you'll find that it's easier and more profitable for you to offer groups because you can make, you know, more money per, you know, more bang for your buck per hour. But also, there's no heavy lifting, you know, because there's so much knowledge that's being, if you're a good facilitator, that's being offered in the group that you kind of are relieved, you know, from that, like, having to deliver it all because people are so excited to share what they know. So if you allow space for that, it's super easy and fun.
Exactly. And I think one of the keys is to get specific about one of two things, at least, in the beginning, the homogeneity of the people you offer it to be sure that there's a uniform aspect of that, such as like women small business owners, or to have a homogeneity of focus, like parents of ADD kids, you know, something that's very specific that around which will be built a coaching group and there'll be mutual interest and you won't have to do as much work about pulling things together that are in common because you have people or a focus that already is in common and you have a group ready to form and develop and your client is the group. It's not seven individuals relating to you, but your client is the group. So whatever you do is to facilitate the process, the cohesiveness, the working alliance of the group itself. So, and if there are other best practices or tips that any of you have, feel free to jump in. And thanks again for all of your information.
Mm-hmm.
Other wins, progress notes, or challenges that would be helpful for us to talk about? Who else wants to check in?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Dave. It's Lalia.
Welcome. How are you?
Good, thank you. Yeah.
Great.
Well, this is very timely because actually this morning I was just thinking about how I was going to formulate doing some group sessions and so I was excited to have that brought up and some thoughts about that. So thank you. That's really wonderful because looking into the new year, there's all these ways. I mean, I assume, well, I'm going under a certain assumption. I'm trying to do maybe collaborate with a woman's organization here and do some group coaching sessions there because they actually have a facility and they offer different kinds of courses and classes. And so, and, you know, I'm thinking of it as a marketing tool for hopefully to catch some people who might want to do individual coaching. So, yeah,
well,
so this was great.
May I coach you for a moment?
Please.
I would suggest that you think of group coaching as an end in itself, not as a way station to the pure gold and just doing simply
right.
the alloy of the of the coaching group. It is a viable entity. The people who engage in group coaching are candidates specifically for that, and they will often do better in groups than they will
in
individually.
The group anyway. Right.
I'm sorry?
Right. Yes, I understand what you're saying.
Okay. Because think about the different configuration of someone who is interested, say, in a teleseminar. They're interested in information. They're not particularly interested in interaction, and they want to get the information, and probably half of them will listen to the recording rather than their lifetime, and few will engage in the discussion. Unless it's pitched in a certain way. Somebody in a group really wants the interaction and the mutual support and the collaboration
right.
with people who've been in similar experiences. So that's a very viable coaching vehicle, and something, as Jen said, can really expand your reach and really exponentially help you with your impact and influence and income. So it's a real real possibility.
Oh yeah, I'm not dismissing that either, you know, at all, as in and of itself.
And the women's group is a great way to begin because you already have a certain cohesiveness and a certain homogeneity of people, and you might have certain interests in that group, and you might then spin off one or two or more groups.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I was thinking, I think that the idea of creating an alliance with an organization that already has, is already attracting people to this. So far, they don't have anything for coaching, but they offer things like, you know, yoga classes for them or whatever. So it's an idea. So
ideal.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Who else?
This is Terry Holmes, and just I'm here, and
welcome.
I'm excited to hear what we have going on today.
Super. What's going on with you?
Just very, very busy. Still looking at learning about blogging and creating a blog and all of that. So I've been investing a bit of time at that with my existing business, doing a lot of year-end necessity stuff.
What's your blog going to be about?
Basically incorporating dancing in, it's more or less involving relationships and talking about relationships and using dancing as an analogy for good relationships, developing skills for conflict resolution and that sort of thing.
Okay. If I were to start coaching right now, and you guys have heard me say some of this, if I were to start coaching right now, the first thing I would do, well, I think you need three things, and then I'm going to talk about what I do first for marketing. I think you need three things. You need a business card, you need a telephone, and you need a story. And the next thing I would do is develop a blog. And I resisted doing a blog. Jen, I'm interested in your experiences with this, too, and those of you who have done this. I resisted doing a blog for a while. Then finally, my last publisher, McGraw-Hill, kept nudging me to do a blog to start a few months before my last book was released. And I did the right style. You know, I branded it, and it was consistent with the book, and it was about the psychology and the neuroeconomics of money. And within 4 months, I had as many subscribers as I had in 4.5 years for my newsletter, because a blog can go viral. You can have it listed on search engines, and it's picked when you do you know, certain keywords in the title in the first paragraph. It's picked up. It's picked up by Google Alerts and distributed in the bottom part of each email. When you do a Google Alerts of blogs with the title, a brief abstract, and a link, and people come and read it, and you have a way to sign up for it. So I think it really, really works well, because it's a premier marketing tool. You know, the last couple of times that I've offered, Jen, I don't know what your experience is here. I'm eager to hear.
I'll wait.
I'll be quiet so that I can hear it in just a second. The last couple of times that I've offered a teleseminar series under my own brand, I put just a little sentence at the end of my blog offering, announcing it and giving the link. And within the first 24 hours, I've had, in one instance, 22, and another instance, 18 people who have signed up for it, just in the first 24 hours, just from the blog. So it's a terrific marketing message and tool. It needs to be branded. You need to plan it and do the writing that you're going to be proud of, maybe even develop an editorial calendar. But it also can serve more than one purpose. The sequel that I've done to The Secret Language of Money, almost half of it were ideas that I developed in the blog and then kept developing and became a second book. So it can really be a multi-purpose engagement. Jen, what's your experience?
Well,
you do a lot of writing.
Yeah, my experience is different than what I would say is the best practice, because, and I'll explain why in a second, but blogs are probably one of the most amazing forms of viral marketing, right? I mean, it's just, like you're saying, a great format for that. And but to your point, like Seth Godin, Small is the New Big, his entire book was just recycled blog posts. Literally, he like named them, like the date each chapter was a title,
yeah.
The date of the thing. Or I think Malcolm Gladwell just did the same thing with his latest book. So definitely write with the idea that it's not like a one-off. It's like it's going to be repurposed in one way or another, and you're going to leverage that somehow. And then, yeah, like the search engines, it's so powerful. My thing is that there is so much noise out there. I feel like the last thing people need is another blog. So, like, in other words, it's got to be really good. Like, don't suck. You know what I mean? Like, make it worth reading, because there's so much out there. And then the other thing is don't blog unless you really want to blog, because there's nothing worse than putting that negative energy into an activity that and will flop, you know, or will not be read. And that was my personal experience. I just didn't want to blog. I don't want to blog. But when I want to blog, I will blog, and it's going to be damn good. But up until then, like anything, you know, like I don't Facebook very much because I don't like it. But I do other things really, really well because I like to do it. So blogging for the sake of blogging, I think, stinks. But blogging because you're ready to and you really want to write can be fabulous.
I totally agree with that, and I think it's useful to do when you have something to say.
And yeah.
One purpose of doing a blog is to write, and the same with a book, is write about what you most want to learn. If there's an area that you're specializing in that you really want to learn about, then as you begin to do the work to do a blog, you'll do your own research. You'll learn. You'll gather information from Google Alerts, from all the related topics and keywords, and read books, and you'll put together. So write about what you most want to learn, and that will be a benefit to you, and it can be a benefit to other people. I mean, I may post once a 3 weeks or once a month at this point, but it's what I really want to say, and I'm really ready to do it. As Jen said, not just, you know, to do one every day or to do three a week and, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Other thoughts? Or other questions or comments about this?
Well, just I really appreciate all the input. And in researching blogs, I've been reading a lot of different blogs. And
good.
Absolutely, there are some that are, you know, really worthwhile, really interesting, and some that it it becomes kind of obvious that it's just filling in space. It's just something to do.
Right.
So that input is really helpful, and I thank both of you. I've also read some of yours, Dave, and really enjoyed that. So.
And you know, be sure you have a prominent place to sign up, because that's what you want, is somebody to sign up so that they don't have to think about going to your blog like they would your website to, you know, sign up for a newsletter, because that way it's delivered to their email box. So that's really what you want, because that's your platform.
Exactly. Well, thanks. I really appreciate all the input.
And when I say that's what I would start out with is a blog, that I would start out with that way before a website. And some people, such as Seth Godin, as you mentioned, don't have a website. Their blog is their website, but he manages to sell. He has like 12 bestsellers. He manages to sell all of his books and do everything he needs to do from his blog. So just a consideration.
Yep, thank you.
Absolutely. Who else? Other wins, progress notes, or things to discuss before we move into the material? Any challenges from your cases or applications of what we're doing that you'd like to talk about? Let me ask you a question. I had originally planned for us to not meet the next 2 weeks and to meet the first week in January. Do we want to vote? Would you like the last class to be next Monday, December 23rd, or would you rather, as we plan to skip the next 2 weeks and do it in January? What's your vote and what's your thought about that?
Hi, this is Jen. I vote 23rd. Wrap it up.
Okay. All right. That's one vote. What else?
This is Terry Holmes. That would work for me as well.
Yeah, Mary Beth's on board with that too.
Okay.
This is Terry Finney. I can't be there.
I'm sorry, this is?
Terry Finney. I cannot be there. The 23rd.
Okay.
This is Lalia. I am actually on the road both the 30th and the 6th. And I'm gonna hope to try to make it on the 23rd. I can at least check. I can make part of it most likely.
Okay.
So I vote yes.
Okay. Terry Finney, would it be okay with you if we did it Monday and you listened to the recorded version of it?
I suppose.
Okay. Is there anyone else who can't make it on Monday? I hear one of you can't make it on the 6th. Anyone else who can't make it Monday? Okay, well, it sounds like the vote is, and I'm sorry, Terry, that you won't be able to be there. We will do our final class then on a week from today. And I have some things I'm going to wrap up and review just briefly at the end. Mary Beth, that you are down for the 6th for the roadmap. Are you able to pull that together to do for next Monday?
Yes, that'll be fine.
Okay. Okay. All right. Great. Well, we'll plan. I'll be sure and get a note out to do. To remind everybody of that. Okay? Anything else to discuss? Anything from your practice that would be helpful? Coaching, business, or marketing?
Dave, this is Terry Holmes again. I had, as I mentioned, and this is something I can email you privately, will I be able to, can you send me an email of where to access the workbook and so forth on line. I do have the hard copy, but I lost my email as a result of a system crash.
Okay, this is something I was going to announce next time. What I'm going to do is gift each of you with a workbook and have my fulfillment house send that to you directly, so you'll have a hard copy of the workbook.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, I'll get them on that and mail that. They have copies on hand, so I'm going to get them to send it to you directly, each of you. Okay?
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, let's talk about living a new success story. And I want to bring some things together here and talk about some applications. The brain's a very, and again, don't hesitate to interrupt me or ask questions. We have some time to discuss. The brain is a really efficient machine. It doesn't waste energy. Simplicity is to take the path of least resistance, to use neurons already familiar with the task. And that's why the brain inclines toward repeating an old story. And this is how neural pathways, as we've talked before, are laid down in the brain by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. So one thing this means is when a client is resistant, don't take it personally. They're frustrated too. They're in this groove automatically. They're in a groove. Together, you can create a path. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information or new context. I want to focus a little bit on decision clarification, because this is something that we do with clients, and I want to give you an idea of what I mean by that and let you hear a story that has to do with decision clarification, can give you an idea of maybe some application as coaches. Researchers Steve Booth Butterfield and Bill Rager, West Virginia University, devised a study that ran ads indicating that one glass of whole milk has the same amount of saturated fats as five strips of bacon. At a press conference, they showed reporters a tube full of fat, the equivalent of the amount of a half gallon of whole milk. By making healthy choices specific and tangible, they were able to decrease the market share. Actually, let me put that a different way. They were able to increase the market share of low-fat milk from 18 to 41%, more than doubling it. In other words, they moved eating healthily from an admirable goal to a specific choice and behavior. And that's one of the things that we do with patients is to with our clients is to move to specificity and to shrink the change to make something tangible and specific. So when you want to affect change, you need to script specific behaviors with a client. When you want to help them create change, enhance active decision making by helping them specify and limit clear options. Change always has to begin at the level of individual decisions and specific behaviors. Here are some leading reasons that people resist change. Now, these are in addition to the mind and brain reasons, remember, that we talked about before. So, and these are simply strategy reasons, strategic aspects to understand as a mentor that can be helpful to us, I think. One is ambiguity aversion. Someone sees the risk of change as greater than the risk of standing still, sort of like better the devil you know than the one you don't. People prefer a known risk to an unknown risk, even if the known risk is high. To make a change requires a leap of faith. It's a move in the direction of the unknown and the unexperienced. You have no proof. So someone avoids ambiguity, because that's where specificity can be very helpful. Also, people feel connected to other people identified with the present situation, and change threatens losing those identified with the old way. And this even resonates with emotional bonds of loyalty, as well as individual status quo and group inertia. Another aspect, there may be no new role models for the new activity, or at least mentors who have been there before. And to surpass those who've been both mentors and colleagues is challenging. You can't know that you have the competence for a new situation that you've never been in before. This may be subtle, but it's a pervasive fear that people have that they're concerned they won't be able to make the transition as well. And I'm mentioning all of these things because this is a distillation of the reasons people resist change so that we can listen for and be aware of and facilitate this process. And at times do preemptive strikes or ladder the process. And the proposed change threatens not only someone's notion of themselves, but also how they're perceived by others and not knowing whether others will respond with support or a competitive jealousy. So this means that it's often helpful to narrow the choices. Look at a specific endpoint, what good enough is, and narrow a choice to fit that goal. So we always want to consider whether the proposed change is a good idea or a bad idea. That just almost goes without saying. Sometimes focusing on the dynamics of change and the transition process may occlude clear judgment about whether it's a really good idea that needs to be fully engaged, especially those who automatically see change as a challenge to be engaged or idealize achievement may not carefully consider this notion. Let's talk for a bit about the process of change and transition. The change is the event. The situation. You change your behavior, you move to a new city, have a baby, take a new job. As we focus on change, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the SMART goals, the things we do in coaching. The transition is the process. It's the internal story of change that is a shift in orientation, even of self-definition, or there wouldn't be a P in roadmap to program new identity. Transition is attention to the seasonal cycles as well as the daily weather. So we help clients create change and embrace transition, meaning to let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve into the new story. Now, consider these four components of transition. These are not something you're going to see with a client or label, but these are just for your reflection and to look at to see if it makes sense to you. One, every transition begins with an ending. Willingly or unwillingly, an ending. It involves letting go of familiar, habitual routines to establish new patterns. And never underestimate the need and the power of letting go. To move to a new position, you have to relinquish a past one. To do things a new way, you have to end the way you do them now. To begin something new, you have to give up some of the old self. To transition to a new possibility, you have to let go of something familiar. Two, people in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. This is a crucial juncture in coaching. We may help a client conceptualize this as an expectable part of change and transition. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. And one possibility is we can reframe this return to the familiar with a client as a way of measuring progress. A validation of moving ahead to see how far they've come. And it's a way also to be sure that you both believe in proceeding and that proceeding's a good thing. Three, the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. The impact and meaning of the transition may bear little resemblance to the significance of the change that caused it. And this can be confusing at first. And let me explain about what I mean by that. Someone can, for example, take the loss of a parent in stride, while next then losing their pet can be an undoing. It's like they're one tragedy behind. So this is something to be aware of what really is the real thing and a stand-in. I was concerned consulted by a large natural resource company to work with an executive who had gone into a downhill spiral when his supervisory duties to two subordinates were transferred to someone else. Now, this was less than 1% of what he did and none of the important things that he did, but for him, it was a narcissistic injury. He was hurt by that because of some aspects of his past, and he was headed to the door, and it was a question of, were they going to fire him or was he going to quit first? And when they initially talked to me, by their estimate, it would cost them between $1.5 million and $1.75 million to replace him. So we did some coaching on his getting righted again, you know, going through the change and the transition and looking at that in perspective. So it was a very brief coaching stint, but it was his dealing with change and transition and catching up with some things that he hadn't quite dealt with in terms of the present experience. And fourth, never underestimate the change back pressure from the system, your family, your company, your friends. It is their self-statement of reaction to change, their expression of status quo. It's an attempt, in a way, to restore the normal order and not do the work of change. In other words, everyone around you in your system has the same desire to return to the status quo and avoid change and avoid the anxiety of change. So it's not like they're out to get you or not supporting you. You're just seeing the manifestation of how their minds and brains work. Jung said the most important problems can't be solved. They have to be outgrown. Let's look at something else that, you know, we talk a little bit in coaching about commitment, but I want to step back a little bit further, the prequel to that. Look at pre-commitment. And here's what I mean by that. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men are sailing home from the Trojan War. He's been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyhow. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them order that they tie him to the mast and ignore all subsequent pleas for release until they're safely past danger. This management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against his predictable and potentially fatal future desire. Willpower alone, he knew, might not have been sufficient, and Odysseus knew that no one is immune to temptation. Now, pre-commitment may be especially useful when it comes to bad habits or obvious weaknesses. It involves present planning and action against the strength of future desires, either by taking certain options off the table or making them prohibitively costly. Pre-commitment works and enables someone to control actions or face their own penalty. An example is the old-style Christmas club accounts, where people put in a certain amount and withdrew it for Christmas, or the current automatic payroll deduction. It's a pre-commitment, a decision you only make once to automatically transfer X amount of money from your savings to your retirement fund. Now, let's talk about commitment devices. As we think about being an accountability partner in coaching, commitment devices may be a consideration. There have been studies on how people self-impose as well as co-create commitments for behaviors they know are in their best interest. We help our kids do this. A piggy bank is a commitment device. Other ways that people counter their own vulnerability and bolster commitment to a better response. Some alcoholics take antabuse. It makes them sick if they drink. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for 3 papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at the chance. Now think about that. Every one of them has the option, every course, always to create their own deadline. So when they were given the option to create their own earlier deadline, they were just prompted to do so. Of course, that's always an option. Freezing a credit card in ice. One of the readers of my blog sent that as a, as a commitment device. People always find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. A study at Harvard Business looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing want products and should products. They would devise ways to either put off purchasing or receiving delivery on the want products in order to ensure that they would do what they should do first. Now, based on the Harvard Business School study, corporations may be helping us bring out our better selves by packaging the should and wants items in unique ways, and that's increasingly a trend. There's a Newsweek article about that not too long ago, before Newsweek ended. We can collaborate with clients to construct commitment devices to do what's in their best interest. For example, to prioritize shoulds and reward with wants reframes the wants as part of a performance ethic. The contingency can remove guilt from what you both knew they're going to do anyhow. And planning is a different scenario than impulsivity. Now, these sound like goofy examples, and they probably are, but I use them to give you very simplistic notions of how you can think about this, because each time you work with a client, you'll think of it in a different way than these examples. But it's just a way to kind of, you know, perturbate your thinking to think about this. Now, I want to, in any thoughts or questions or additions, I'm very eager to welcome. I want to review now some of the most frequent mistakes made in writing a new story, whatever kind of story that is, life, money, wellness, career, relationship. One, not knowing you don't know. Now, how can people know they don't know something? We believe we know, which blinds us to our ignorance and creates a confirmation bias, because we look for what we believe and we give selective inattention to what we don't. So this also means that we need to be reflective and to mentalize, to be aware of how we think about things and reflect on that. And to know to ask is half the answer. Two, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this may be a correct strategy, but it can also stop us from considering other right answers, other strategies that might be even more effective. So we need to ask our client or ask ourselves, and then what? What else? Now, number three. If you're following the outline, you know what number three is, but I want to introduce it with this brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, however, planned their strategy, and then they decided they would jump off. How many were left? Anyone?
Five.
Exactly. Five were left because they only planned and decided. They didn't commit to act. Number three is procrastination. Now, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We have little sense of urgency, which can contribute to a lack of focus. When the two-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in the final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. Now, the Texans are huge exceptions to that, but stick with my story. This imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases efforts. Now, in our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is an abstraction and something we acknowledge, but don't really internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. Four, inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. And you know my belief that regulation of states of mind is the key success strategy. This begins with knowing your strengths, your limitations, your biological cycles, your states of mind, how to enter and exit your states of mind, when you perform best. cluster activities that require the same state of mind. Know which states of mind work best for a particular task. And I've used the example more than once. Writing and editing, two different states of mind to be done at different times, not to be mixed. Identify what enhances your energy, anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer. Identify what depletes your energy, toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus. 5, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't know what it would be like to pursue them, since you haven't done it before, this uncertainty can add to decision paralysis. What looks like resistance can simply be a lack of clarity about how to take the next step. People are more likely to change when new behavior is crystal clear, not vague or absent. Eat a healthier diet or save for the future are both vague and abstract. When you want to affect change in yourself or catalyze it in others, be specific about scripting behaviors. When you want to enhance active decision-making for clients, help them limit and specify and clarify their options. Change always has to begin at the level of individual decisions and specific behaviors. 6, too many choices. Some studies show how an HR department or individual investment advisor can provide too many choices, and the extra options backfire, leading to decision paralysis. Many investment options of different kinds of stock and bond funds, real estate investment trusts, various kinds of equities and funds and accounts are usually offered as options, and each has several categories or choices within it. One study was done for each 10 options offered, the employee's rate of participation goes down by 2%. So at some point, choice debilitates rather than liberates, and someone retreats to the default position of not making a choice. Now this, and you probably heard this, this is a classic study in decision paralysis. It was done at gourmet grocery stores. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. And on an alternate weekend, they were given a choice of 6 jams. And each time they were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased. When 24 varieties were available for tasting, 3% purchased. When only 6 varieties were available, 30% purchased. Tenfold difference. Too many choices resulted in a decline of purchases because with too many choices, people just feel overwhelmed and resort to the comfort zone to do nothing and retreat from any decision making. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's persistence, the willingness to stay the course. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion. One extra degree of effort in business and in life can separate the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy, I didn't even know there were that many at that time, turned down a guy who then decided to publish his book himself and sell it out of the back of his car. And it's a really unlikely title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. To get what you've never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. Lord Eliot put it in a very simple way. Perseverance is not a long race. It is many short races, one after another. 8. Not following success trails. Have you said or heard some version of following? Well, I want to play a bigger game, but I'm not sure what it is or how to do it. I want to create wealth, but I don't exactly have a plan. Decide how you want to expand. Then pick success trails to follow. When my my very good friend, Art, heard that I was transitioning from psychoanalytic practice and completed my coach training, he came to Houston to take me to dinner. A few years earlier, he left IBM at a very early retirement time as a senior executive and started his own consulting corporation. He showed me how he chose five very successful people who had done something very similar to what he had done, took them to lunch or dinner to pick their brains about what he wanted to do, and he advised me to do the same. It worked very well for both of us. Some business people with instant global recognition pick his brain for substantial picking fees. So think about creating a support team, maybe an advisory board, a networking group, engage a mentor, join a mastermind group. And we're going to talk some more next time about things that we'll do, I'll do as a group in terms of the registry and the mentor group and various aspects of practice promotion that I will help you each with. Let's talk about adaptation to success. This is, I think, really important. Success is never final. Don't get complacent. Testing is as important as postulating. Test ideas out. Revise them. Make it your story told with your voice. One reason to be very clear about your needs and ideals and to have a clear idea of your story is to deal with your success. It's at least as challenging, I think more so at times, to deal with success as it is with adversity or scarcity. And my prediction, each of you will have a new level of success that you haven't had before. So that's why I think it's important to be ready for it. The writer F. Scott Fitzgerald had just completed his novel, This Side of Paradise. He was riding high, a successful writer in every aspect. He had just married a beautiful wife, had a storybook life. Then Fitzgerald said, "Riding in a taxi one afternoon between very tall buildings, I began to bawl. I had everything I wanted, and I knew I would never be so happy again. The problem," he felt, "is that every story must end." And he then set about writing the ending to his own story. He descended into depression and alcoholism and died an early death. His belief came true because he wrote the story. Elvis became the story of success, but it was not that story that brought him to success. But he identified with the success story and lost himself in it. His true story ended as he lay cold on the bathroom floor at age 42, full of drugs and the trappings of success. These are two guys who needed mentor coaches not to become successful, but to deal with success. And think about how very true that is for so many people. As you know, I work with professional athletes and actors, and that is absolutely true for them, and it's true for anyone who begins to be successful, to really deal with that, to continue and grow that success is where we can be of very special use to people. Failure and success are both stories, external stories about events, meaning that you have to continue with efforts and change to sustain success. Either story, failure or success, can change. It can continue, grow, or end. To continue with a success story is to continue doing that which created the success. After you arrive at success, you can't stop doing the things that created the success and only inhabit the success story, the things that having to do with success itself and the enjoyment. Soon then, success will wither, perhaps, and the story change. You can become defined by the story. And again, I want to say one more time, it's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. Another aspect of adaptation to success is to bring back into the foreground regularly your why. Why you get up in the morning. And reflect on your challenge, your satisfaction, your creative effort, your pleasure, your passion, and your achievement in terms of your why. Now, let's look at creating a new belief. How we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories get told so much or so often that they achieve the status of becoming a personal myth. If I were just loved enough, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it often and in every way that you can. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results of the new belief, the new experience. Here's a story that illustrates that point. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in 1916 in Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious as his competitors. But he priced his at 5 cents, and the other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People concluded or believed that his hot dogs were inferior. They attributed poor quality ingredients to his products. And his sales were not increased. In fact, they went further south when he offered free root beer and free pickles. This just furthered the perception that the value must be substandard. Then Handworker had an insight. He thought he realized why this was the case. And he came up with a new ploy. He did two things. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes, and he raised his prices. They began selling well. People assumed that if a physician were eating his food, and it was priced at least as much as the others, that it had to be good. And it became a national phenomenon. Nathan's famous hot dogs are still around today. The value we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take some period of time. It can occur quickly, or it can be a process. And the process of changing beliefs is just that, a process, not an event. It can be planned, though, step by step, with incremental progression. And it takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anyone else's. Don't compare your inside to someone else's outside or your journey, your timetable, your progress with anyone else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. However long it takes, you can make it worth it. And you specifically will know the difference between dosing, timing, and titrating and procrastination. And that's an important distinction. In changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you'll also be changing your mind as well as your brain. The choices generate the moment-by-moment life you create. The programming of your internal map of reality, your software, determines what it will be. At any moment in time, neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and focus. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. DNA downloads information from expression of its code. We now know it goes in the other direction as well. In other words, our experiences, our beliefs can turn genes on and turn them off to determine the major extent of the expression of DNA-based information. Dr. Bruce Lipton summarized this finding, emphasizing that genes can't turn themselves on or off, but adapt to our beliefs and our experiences. Focus also determines, as a major factor, what we engage, and often simply what we ask someone will determine their focus. A last note on beliefs and the resulting attribution of value. On a January morning, during rush hour, an ordinary-looking guy dressed in jeans and a baseball cap took out his violin in a subway station in Washington, D.C. For the next 43 minutes, he performed one of the most challenging pieces composed for the violin, Bach's Sonatas and Partitas for Unaccompanied Violin. 1,097 people walked by. He was barely noticed, just playing on a passenger platform like an average street performer. In fact, only, I've seen the video, some of you may have too, of this study, only one person actually stopped and recognized him and enjoyed the concert. His name? Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists alive, who regularly performs to sold-out crowds at concert halls throughout the world. His violin, a $3.5 million Stradivarius. In this study by the Washington Post, the D.C. commuters heard a world-class concert, but the value they attribute, all except for one person, to his performance was based on their perception of how he looked and how he was dressed. Value perception, value attribution, let's say, is our own shortcut to determine how we judge what we see, even what's worthy of our attention. Then, the value we assign shapes our perception. One thing I want to add, and any thoughts or questions, anything else you'd like to expand on or talk about from any of this?
Dave, this is Jen. I have a comment and a question. We were just talking about this earlier this morning. I'd ran my mastermind group, and one of the gals was saying that she read Bruce Lipton. She's a fan of his Biology of Emotions, is it? Biology of Emotions? Biology of Beliefs.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Anyway, so we got to talking, and we started wondering whether our words can shape our beliefs even before we truly believe it, or does the belief have to be in place before our can our words create a new action or habit, like positive action or habit, or do we have to do the action and habit first to show ourselves that we can believe that? So which comes first, the belief or the new action? In other words,
It can be any of the three. It depends partly on the person and the inclination of what their style is and what they lead with. I would refer each of you, and this is a book that I'm incorporating a summary of to my mastermind group. Words Can Change Your Brain. It's a great book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a synopsis of a number of neuroscience studies written really well. And it's a book I think can be very useful to you as coaches. Words Can Change Your Brain. So that, you know, any one of those three can be the answer depending on how someone leads. Some people, their style is that they'll get it all in place and get everything set and then change their behavior. And other people will have a behavior change and sort of realize that doesn't fit with their system, and they'll change their belief.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes an external event can crystallize a need to respond and the whole subsequent reflection on that. So I think it can be any one of those three. Now, usually someone has a preferred style, but
I think
in coaching, I think we need to be aware of how important both focus and physiology are in determining a state of mind, and how important words are in determining some of the aspects of change, as well as the concepts and beliefs. So that's a great question, and I think the answer is not as ambiguous as it sounds, because it definitely can be each.
Yeah, I like that. I like that it's not just one. The cookie cutter, one size fits all, lately hasn't been resonating so much with me. Yeah, that's good. Good. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Yeah, thanks for the question. That's super. One thing I want to highlight just briefly is something we don't talk very much about in coaching is having a correct paradigm. You know, we've touched on this before, but I want to reintroduce it here. Let me tell you a brief story to illustrate. One night on a camping trip, Sherlock Holmes wakes up Watson and says, "Look at the stars. What do you deduce?" Watson looks for a minute and says, "Well, I see millions of stars, many of which resemble our sun, which most likely have their own planets, which most likely have life forms, like us. So I deduced that there's life on other planets. And Sherlock said, "Now, you idiot, somebody's stolen our tent." Now, consider each of these paradigms as a conditioned response to certain stimuli, because you'll hear derivatives of some of these belief systems from your clients as they move with you toward becoming their own authority. One, genetic determinism. Your genes are doing it to you. It's an inherited trait fashioned by a long-standing DNA copy. If you're Irish, well, that means you're going to have a temper. Psychic determinism. Your parents did it to you. Environmental determinism. Well, your boss or your spouse or the economy is doing it to you. Now, the antithesis of each of these paradigms of determinism is mastery, with our own sense of authority, creating our own story, that whatever we think and feel and experience is what we create each moment. Remember this. What remains unconscious is most likely to be perceived as fate. And our fears are not made conscious until we go for our dreams. Mastery takes time. Don't skip any steps. Decide what you want to measure in order to achieve your total goals. You have to measure what you want more of. And I hear this every time, every day when I'm at LA Fitness over the PA system. What gets measured gets improved. It's redundant, but it's right. All problems have exceptions. And this is an important aspect, I think. A research team, this is a large-scale research team on the West Coast, studied families presenting with issues. And what they looked at, instead of doing the usual kinds of evaluations and family therapies and all the various things, they looked at the exception, the time when the problem would have happened but somehow did not. So instead of focusing on all the details of the problems, the research paid particular attention to how the exception occurred. All the details of who, what, where, when, and how were focused on the exception rather than all the problems. The results, changes occurred much more rapidly, because what that meant was that they focused on the solution rather than the problems, and focusing on the solution brought into focus the possibilities. So this means we want to find out with the client what's worked, when they feel calmer or better or more peaceful, when they feel more confident, when they have experienced effectiveness and mastery, how they've conceptualized particular strategies. And part of this, then, is simply developing a new operating system. And that's really what we've been talking about. I want to conclude this with two aspects. One is to look at just an overview of the life stages of success and then do a final exercise with you. Now, the life stages of success really is moving beyond the wide-angle lens to time-lapse photography. This is just for your conceptualization. Success may mean different things at different points in adult life, in the different developmental phases of life. And I can summarize this better than all of my words by giving you a quote for each of the points here I want to make. This quote is from Ruby Dee and I Dream a World. This is how it may look in a relationship. This is how she puts it. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. And here's a way of looking at individual success. This is from Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, then you can figure out what's really important. Ideally, before, and you'll achieve it much more quickly and more satisfactorily. A caveat, be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective. This is from my favorite non-living essayist, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. I want to do a final exercise with you. Let me suggest that you put your phones on mute and find a way, if you can, tuck your phones between your, if you don't have a headset, between your chin and your shoulders so you can have your hands free, and that you can sit and really totally comfortably relax in your chairs. I'd like you to close your eyes and take a deep breath of relaxation in and breathe out any tension. With your eyes closed, imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risks that you should or shouldn't have taken? Keep your eyes closed and look very carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face, your hands, at your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are and who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. Now, open your eyes and gradually get back into a present state. And we have just a couple of minutes for a discussion. Any thoughts or responses? Any reaction to that exercise that you would like to share?
Yeah, Dave, this is Jen. I don't want to be the one always chiming in, but that was moving, especially when I was asked to look into my 90-year-old eyes, because I could, the eyes are the window to the soul, so it was like I was peering at a different level of me, not an age, but like a different level, like this knowing, level, like higher knowing. And that piece about asking, like, is there something that you would kind of, you didn't say this, but tell yourself now or that you might be missing now, that was just a great download of freedom for me. Very freeing.
Interesting. Great. Thank you for sharing that. That's
powerful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anyone else?
This is Tisha.
Yes.
I just The exercise, thank you for sharing that exercise, facilitating and sharing it with us, by the way. It was very powerful for me as well. I think for me it also reminded me of that we do know. You know, I think we know more than we think we do. And sometimes it's really about, you know, using some of the words you discussed during your lecture, but whether it's reflection or whether it's just giving ourselves space and time or even giving ourselves some distance in this exercise or sort of looking at ourselves from a different perspective. If we really want to know what some of the answers are or want to really see the deeper parts of ourselves, we can access that, and there's a lot there to kind of inform us. So that was a great reminder of that. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Super. Any other comment before we wrap up? Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate all of your energy and input. Look forward to picking up with you next time, and I'll send a reminder around that we'll meet next Monday at the same time for our final seminar. Thanks very much. Have a great rest of the week. Bye now.